All right, probably a fairly familiar story for many of you, but we're going to be looking at David and Goliath, and looking at particularly after this part, because a lot of the Sunday school stories don't talk about what happened afterwards. And I have Wilson here. He's going to be my assistant. If you aren't familiar with who Wilson is, he starred in a movie called Castaway. It wasn't all that great, I don't think, but Tom Hanks was co-starred in that, and I think Wilson did the best job. He was the main actor of that film, but and I do love Tom Hanks, so I'm not trying to insult him or anything. But I'm also going to have Wilson kind of assist me in being the metaphorical head, just kind of the role he had with our Man Cave series trailer. So yeah, we're going to get started. And we're going to go through the whole David and Goliath story and talk through some of the details on that. But then we're going to focus a lot of what happens after the stone flies. And in the aftermath of that, I think there's this major challenge that I want to press in upon. And we'll do a comparison between David and Saul and finish off with the significance of David, or not David's, but Goliath's head. So we're going to be in First Samuel 17 this morning. Feel free to grab a Bible, open up your Bibles to that. We're going to be looking at the heads that we face, and then the heads that we should carry. So let's get started. Let me give you some background, because David is a boy. He's the youngest son in his family, and so his job was watching over the sheep. He was a shepherd for the family. But then the prophet Samuel comes in, and Samuel comes and anoints David as the next king of Israel, which is slightly problematic, because there's a current king of Israel who probably would like to have a say in who becomes next king, but King Saul is not aware of this anointing yet. And King Saul has had some victories. King Saul has seen some great things happen as he's been in charge. Israel has been freed from their oppression from various different peoples. And they've kind of carved out their own territory in the highlands, and they have their own kingdom, independence, and that kind of thing. But the Philistines are now marching on their border, and they're getting ready to invade, and so the army is responding to that. And I think the Philistines are really trying to see if this young nation is going to survive, if it can kind of push this young nation to kind of crumbling and being disunified, and Saul is trying to hold all this stuff together, and he's a little timid at this point, because God has already confronted Saul and told him that he has rejected him as king, because Saul had failed to disobey God and some very specific commands that he gave him. So Saul has a lot going on in his mind. He's trying to take care of this young nation. He wants to make sure that there's this unity within the nation. He doesn't want to send his soldiers into some suicide mission. Well, let's get started and look in our passage this morning, starting in verse 1 in 1 Samuel chapter 17. So now the Philistines gathered their forces for war and assembled at Succoth in Judah. They pitched camp at Ephine's Demon between Succoth and Azekah. Saul and the Israelites assembled and camped in the Valley of Elah and drew up their battle line to meet the Philistines. The Philistines occupied one hill and the Israelites another, with a valley between them. A champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. He was over 9 feet tall, and he had a bronze helmet on his head and wore a coat of scale armor of bronze weighing 5,000 shekels. Okay, so the Philistines are camped out at the border here. I have a satellite map of this. And so here you have Azekah. That would have been a Philistine town. Down here would be Succoth over here. And you have the Philistines camping out on this hill somewhere around in here. And then the Israelites would be camping over here. And so they have this valley between them, a little brook where David's going to pick up the stones. And so if the Philistines can get through this valley, they have a way of going up into the highlands to north of Jerusalem, where Saul's hometown is, where the capital of Israel is at this point. And so the Israelite army is the only thing standing in the way between them and being oppressed once again by the Philistines. So actually, go ahead and go to the next slide. This is me and Natalie at this valley. We had the privilege of going there. We're standing on top of Azekah, is a little hill there. And then over here, we're standing in the brook where David would have picked up some stones. In fact, I have a little stone from that valley, and probably a stone similar to what David would have used as he faces off against Goliath. You know, this is an interesting thing. There's a lot of pressure, I think, on King Saul at this point. What are they going to do as the Israelite army is trying to figure out what do they do with Goliath, because he's huge, he's heavily armored, he's basically like a human tank. He has these strong, massive weapons. And so what do you do with that? Now, I play basketball on Wednesday mornings and Friday mornings with a couple guys, and I don't know if you guys are familiar with Steve Techman. He sometimes plays the bass up here. He's kind of a big guy. He's not 9 feet tall or anything, but sometimes I have to guard Steve, and I'm not a small guy, but when I'm guarding Steve, he can basically like push me around the court like I'm a broom. So one time we're playing, I'm guarding him, and I knock knees with Steve. And I stop immediately because I think my knee cap is like broken off. And I'm like wailing in pain. I'm like, ah! And then I hear Steve say, "Did someone touch me?" And I'm just like, oh, Steve, you're so big. I can't handle it. You see, the size matters. And when the Israelites are facing this huge giant, they're not sure what to do. They're kind of tiny people. I have a photograph I want to show you. This guy to the right there, he is the tallest man ever recorded at 8 feet 11 inches. So probably close to the height of Goliath. And that is a normal guy for that time, about 5'8", something like that. So kind of a big discrepancy there, right? How would you like to face the big tall guy who's weighed down with armor and ready to come at you, when you're actually smaller than this guy here? Because the Israelites were kind of small people. So that's what they're facing. And that's a huge, huge challenge. If we look at our next passage, we see Goliath proposing this offer. He says, "Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? Are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down to me. And if he is able to kill or fight me and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you'll become our subjects and serve us." Then the Philistines said, "This day I defy the ranks of Israel. Give me a man, let us fight each other." And on hearing the word of the Philistines' words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified, and rightfully so, right? What are they going to do about this? This guy is huge. They don't have a champion who can face off with this guy. They don't have anyone who can come close. And not to mention, guys, the Israelite army doesn't even have the weaponry to face the Philistine army. We find that out in 1 Samuel 13:19. We learn that there's not a blacksmith in the Israelite nation. No, not a blacksmith could be found the whole land of Israel, because the Philistines had said, otherwise the Hebrews will make swords and spears. So when they previously oppressed the Israelites, they made sure they had no way of making weapons. This is a rough situation. Goliath's challenge continued morning and evening for 40 days. And meanwhile, Jesse sends little David to carry supplies to his brothers who are serving in the army and to find out what's going on with the battle. And when David arrives, he comes up to this and sees the Israelite army lining up, and then he sees Goliath come out, and then Goliath starts proclaiming and defying, and the Israelites run away. So in our next passage, David asked the man standing near him, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" Notice how David sees Goliath a little bit differently. Now, David's thinking is different. He thinks Goliath is this problem that should be dealt with, that must be dealt with, that he is defying the armies of the living God, and so it must be addressed. It must be addressed now. Now, there was a time when the Philistines actually feared God. And I wanted to share this with you. This is in 1 Samuel 4. And this is when Israel and the Philistines were fighting previously. When the Ark of the Lord's Covenant came into the camp, all of Israel raised such a great shout that the ground shook. Hearing the uproar, the Philistines asked, What's all this shouting in the Hebrew camp? And when they learned that the Ark of the Lord had come into the camp, the Philistines were afraid. "A god has come into the camp," they said. "We're in trouble. Nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us! Who will deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? They are the gods who struck the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the desert." See, God's fame had reached the Philistines from Egypt. But that doesn't help the Israelites in this situation right now, because right now there's this huge giant who's defying them. And so they got to figure out, what are we going to do with this crisis? Do we just kind of hold here and hold this valley and pray that they don't invade? Well, that's what they're doing at this point. King Saul has a lot of things on his mind, trying to figure out what to do with this new nation, how he can keep things together. Now, King Saul was a tall man. He was a head taller than the rest of the Israelites. And he was the one that had actually armor and a sword. And so he has some of the advanced weaponry that the regular Israelite soldiers don't have. Saul is actually the natural choice for the one to face off against Goliath. But instead, King Saul wants someone else to take on the fight. And he tells his people, "Hey, I will give you a reward for someone who's willing to fight Goliath." And so David responds. He's like, "Okay, I'll fight Goliath," because David believes that this evil needs to be confronted. And David believes that God will fight for the person who stands against Goliath's defiance. Now Saul, reacting to this, doesn't believe David has a chance against the giant because, one, the giant has been training to fight since he was David's age. And David tells Saul, "God is going to protect me." Well, let's look at this passage. David said to Saul, "Your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it and struck it and rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair and struck it and killed it. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, because he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "Go and the Lord be with you." Now, it's hard to believe that this completely changes Saul's mind at this point, right? Like, Saul sending David out to this battle just violates every, like, child labor law there is. It's crazy to think that Saul all of a sudden thinks, "Oh, well, okay, you can do this then," right? When Saul himself struggled on depending on the Lord to help him face problems, he's going to let David depend on the Lord to face this great giant. But David faces off with Goliath. Saul offers his armor, which in some ways is this kind of ironic twist where Saul probably should have been the person going to face Goliath, and yet Saul's armor doesn't fit David, and so David has to go without anything except the Lord. And he takes a staff, he takes a sling and some stones. But let's just pause right here and contrast Saul and David. Okay? Saul has this big responsibility. He's the first king of this new nation. He's trying to keep his people together. He doesn't want to send his soldiers necessarily on this suicide mission where they're all trying to fight against the Philistines, because that's just not going to work. And he's just kind of holding back and waiting. See, the problem Saul has here is he has this horizontal vision, okay? He is only looking from this earthly perspective, this practical perspective on what he can do, what his army can do, the resources that he has, the skill set that he has, and what he can achieve himself. It's the same mindset that gets Saul in trouble time after time again with God, and why God ultimately rejected Saul as king over his people. David's perspective, though, is different. You see, David's vision is vertical. David's concern is that God should receive honor and respect and praise that he's due. And so for David, as he looks at this arrogant man mocking God and mocking God's people, he says, "This, something has to be done about this. And I know a God who has all the resources I need to fight this battle." Now, interesting, Goliath doesn't actually defy or taunt God directly. Instead, he taunts and defies God's people's army. And yet, David says, this cannot happen, this cannot stand, because God and God's people need to be honored. Now, earlier on in 1 Samuel, in chapter 2, God is really confronting Eli the priest and how he's kind of run things and allowed his sons to do things that were not acceptable to him. And God says to Eli, "Those who honor me, I will honor. But those who despise me will be disdained." You see, there's another prominent figure in ancient times who taunted and defied God directly. And we find him in Exodus 5. His name was Pharaoh. And after Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says, let my people go, so that they may hold a festival to me in the desert." And Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord. I will not let Israel go." Okay, you can just hear Pharaoh's confidence and this defiance in his voice. The problem is, Pharaoh should have known the Lord, the God of Israel. Because it was actually the God of Israel who gave Pharaoh all of the power that he had at this day. You see, 400 years previously, it was the God of Israel who sent Joseph, or actually sent a dream, and then sent Joseph to interpret the dream for Pharaoh that said there was going to be this great famine. And that great famine ended up consolidating all of the wealth, all of the land, all of the livestock, all the crops, all the people under Pharaoh's authority. And so Pharaoh went from this like regional king to this overwhelmingly leader of the world at the time. Because of Pharaoh's defiance, once God was done proving himself to Pharaoh, all of Egypt would not easily forget the one true God. So much so that his fame was spread even into Canaan, up to the Philistines. I think this is a common attitude towards God. Who is God that I should obey him? Why should I give up my life and my desires to follow after this God? That's Goliath's question, essentially. For those of us who believe in the Creator God, who know what Jesus did to forgive us of our failings and our sin, does that bother you? That someone might dismiss our God and his glory and his honor. You know, for me, if I'm super honest, I probably have more righteous indignation for when Goliath mocks David than I am when Goliath is mocking God. And as I was reflecting on that and thinking through, is that because of my culture or something that I don't naturally defend those in authority? I have maybe this attitude that authorities can kind of take care of themselves, so to speak, and maybe that's kind of the American independence idea. I don't know. But I was thinking through this. If there was an adult mocking this disabled child, I would be up in arms. I would start flailing. I would be throwing fists. I would go at that person. But if someone insults the President of the United States, he can take care of himself. I don't really care. We defend the oppressed, but we do not honor our kings. In politics, maybe you do honor your person, the person who matches in your political bent and the policies that you like. And when they're in charge, you're like, oh yeah, let's honor the king, honor the president. But do we do what Paul and Peter commands in honoring our leaders, irregardless who they are? Remember, Peter and Paul were honoring the Roman emperors, these guys that were calling for their heads. I think as followers of the most high authority that there is, we should be a group that changes this idea that we honor those in authority over us. That's not to say that we agree with all their policies or that we don't even challenge their lifestyle and what they're doing, but it means we honor them for the position that they have. And that includes local leaders. That includes police officers. That includes teachers, youth, or even pastors and spiritual authorities. This points to the bigger issue. Do we defend the honor of the God who died and gave himself for us? Because David believes that's the job of God's people, to defend God's honor. Do you agree with that? Those who honor me, I will honor. Those who despise me will be disdained. When we look at the story, do the Israelites really believe that God can defeat Goliath? If so, they should step out onto the field. What defiance or mocking or taunting of God do you see? Are we willing to address that? Do we believe that God will be with us to help us? I call these taunts of God and this defiant attitude against God and his people boasting heads. And I think we're called to face off against these boasting heads. And if we use Wilson here as our little object lesson, is there a boasting head that you need to confront this week? And David say, military conquest showed the might of a nation's God. The might of our God, though, is not shown through our military conquest of other people. It's shown by our hope, our purpose, the truth that we hold to, the love that we share, the sacrifice that we're willing to make for others. We're called to warn people. We're called to persuade people to see things differently according to the view of our God. We're called to pray for hard change. Is there someone that you know that needs to be challenged? Their taunts and their boasts are wrong and disrespectful to God. How could God help challenge that person? Well, let's look at what happens to David as he confronts Goliath here. Because Goliath just openly mocks David at this point. If we look at verse 43 through 44, he said to David, "Am I a dog that you come at me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. "Come here," he said, "I'll give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field." Now, David's not shaken by this. He's confident in who has his back. And so he responds and declares confidently to Goliath in these next few verses. David said to the Philistine, "You come against me with sword and spear and javelin, But I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will hand you over to me, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. And today I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the earth, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. And David runs up to Goliath, takes a stone with his sling and throws it. The rock hits Goliath in the forehead, and Goliath falls. Now, according to Sir Isaac Newton, the law of conservation of momentum dictates that a moving object, when it strikes a stationary object, that stationary object should be pushed in the direction of the movement of the previous object. I think I have that right. I talked to a physics professor before, but I may have messed that up. So in my mind, what that means is when this stone that hits Goliath in the forehead with such force that it actually crushes his skull, that he should like fall backwards. But that's not what we see happens in this event. Instead, Goliath falls forward, bowing before David. Now, you might say, well, that doesn't seem like a big deal. I think there's this great theological meaning here, because this actually isn't a battle between this great Philistine champion warrior and the little shepherd boy. This is actually a battle between God, the creator, Lord of the Israelites, Yahweh, versus Dagon, God of the Philistines. And so when God is fighting his battle, he makes clear who is superior. When God fought the gods of Egypt, he demonstrated his power over the sun god by making it dark, over the Nile River by turning it to blood, over the god of insects, over the god of livestock, over the god of health, over the god of life itself. When Jesus is confronted and being arrested by the soldiers in the Garden of Gethsemane, when Jesus identifies who he is, the soldiers must bow before him. They're forced to the ground. A few years before this showdown between David and Goliath, the Philistines had this battle with Israel where they won and they took the Ark of the Covenant. And this was a holy piece of furniture where God's presence dwelt, where the Israelites used as part of their worship of God. In this passage in 1 Samuel 5, it says, "Then the Philistines carried the ark into Dagon's temple and set it beside Dagon. And when the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, there was Dagon, fallen on his face on the ground before the ark of the Lord. They took Dagon and put him back in his place, but the following morning when they arose, there was Dagon, fallen on his face on the ground before the ark of the Lord. His head and his hands had been broken off and were lying on the threshold. Only his body remained." The Philistines had so much trouble with the ark, they finally sent it away from them back to Israel. See, this battle is God's battle, and he claimed the victory. And the same is true for us. God will claim the victory, but we have to be willing to step out onto the field and engage. Defending God's honor is worth the fight. And when we take the field, God will take over the battle. Now, our Sunday school, children's Sunday school stories and that kind of thing stop right about there. Sometimes maybe they talk about the Philistines fleeing and all that good stuff. But they don't talk about where David runs over to Goliath, takes Goliath's sword, the sword that he boasted would be used to kill David, and chops Goliath's head off. It does seem a little over the top, and it's probably not a pleasant thing to talk to kids with, so I'm not saying that we shouldn't just stop right there. In fact, people kind of wonder if Goliath was actually dead by the rock hitting his forehead and he falls over and he's dead, why go over and chop off his head? Well, when David goes over and chops off Goliath's head, it signifies to everyone there that Goliath isn't just knocked out. He's not just stunned. He's done. He's done fighting. His life is over. And not just that, but the God of the Israelites is fighting for them. And so what happens, the Israelites are emboldened and they chase after the Philistines. The Philistines freak out and they run the opposite direction and they seek shelter in Gath, which is 5 miles away. It's the nearest walled town. And some of them even go to Ekron, which is 10 miles away. And Israel just routs their army. Meanwhile, David doesn't take part in that. He is summoned to King Saul. If we look at verse 57, it says, as soon as David returned from killing the Philistine, Abner, which was the general of the army, took him and brought him before Saul, with David still holding the Philistine's head. A little gruesome, but there's David. Now, this is a big deal because the head serves as an object lesson for the king who wouldn't trust God. He didn't think David could initially beat Goliath, and I get that. But David was essentially instructing the king, who should have been the one fighting, that God is worth relying on, that God is trustworthy, that God will protect his people. If you're here this morning and you're just overwhelmed, I want you to know, we serve a God who can intervene. We serve a God whom the obstacles or the sin or the problem that you're facing is not a big thing. God can handle it. It doesn't matter if you're fairly incapable or you have all the skill and the resources at your fingertips. God can do far more than you think, than you imagine, than you ask for when you follow him. Set aside your analysis, set aside your assessments, and simply follow after God. Now, God's not interested in your own personal dreams, your own desires. He's not going to build your kingdom. He wants to extend his. But if you fight for his honor, he will honor you. So what are some giants that not necessarily terrorize us, but defy and attack our God? Or maybe some institutions that challenge our faith and make us question whether or not God really cares? What groups mock the people of God and say that we're irrelevant or insignificant? Church, is there an enemy that wants to destroy us? Is there a group that we fear their power and influence? I was thinking about this, and I thought about three things that we really get hammered for. The first one is believing that life is a gift from God and that abortion should be eliminated. The second is believing that sexual activity only should take place within a marriage, which is between a man and a woman. And that one, we get hit around just about every angle. The final one is that God is the creator. Everything comes from him. Are there some things that we need to confront? Our next elective class is on connecting with God. And from time to time, we offer a class on homosexuality. I'm hoping that we can offer that again in August. But I want to talk about a giant that Christians are afraid to address. And I get it. It's a tough, it can be confusing, it's a complicated situation. But Jesus loved the broken, but boldly confronts sin. And that's true in every one of our lives. It's important how we handle and address these issues. But we have no reason to cower, to be afraid when we're honoring our God, because our God is greater than all of these. And he can use the things that we say as we speak in truth and in love and share our own struggles and our own victories. Has God maybe been preparing you for a specific battle? When you look at David, David was kind of prepared for this. He had faced some battles with protecting the sheep. Do you need to develop some experience and experience talking about spiritual things? Do you maybe need to learn how to speak winsomely and persuasively? Sir Isaac Newton said, tact is the knack of making a point without making an enemy. See, we're not actually trying to cut off people's heads. Let me be clear with that. That is not our goal. But we're looking for transformed souls. Just as Jesus has transformed us, we can be the catalyst that brings someone else to Jesus so that they can see the transformation that he provides. The apostle Peter said that we need to be ready to give an account of the hope that resides in us. So are you ready? Have you prepared? Have you trained? What giant makes you doubt God's deliverance? What head do you need to face off with this week? Now, in our last passage that we're going to look at this morning in 1 Samuel 17, verse 54, it talks about what David did with the Philistines' weapons, with his armor, but it also says that David took the Philistines' head and brought it to Jerusalem. Now, that's kind of interesting because at this point in time, Jerusalem is nothing. It's a Jebusite city. It doesn't have any, governing significance. The palace isn't there. The temple isn't there. None of that stuff is there yet. In fact, it won't be for another 20 years that David himself is going to be the one that conquers Jerusalem and makes it his capital. And so what is David doing here by taking Goliath's head 23 miles up the mountains to Jerusalem? You know, I think sometimes when we hear these great stories of God's deliverance, we can have these doubts. Maybe in David's time, there's these doubts. Did God actually deliver us? Did he actually defeat the great champion of the Philistines? Was this little boy the one whom chopped off Goliath's head? You know, whenever we have doubts and things, there are proofs that we can seek out if we're willing to. And maybe some of you are struggling with thinking that this is all just fairy tales. This is just this exaggerated hero legend. Oh, guys, there are things in archaeology that corroborates Israel's influence in the region during the time of the kings. If you go to Jerusalem, you can see the foundations of King David's palace. They're there. They've discovered them. They found them, which is awesome. You see, the Bible is one of the greatest archaeological resources of the ancient world. But even in David's day, the Israelites had to be wondering, did this really happen? Well, when David shows up, and he's got his little object lesson in his hand, and he says, look, God is great. God has delivered us. See the head of Goliath. Man, that had to build confidence. Man, that had to be encouraging. Our God has delivered us from the Philistines. So why Jerusalem then? Why take the head all the way up to Jerusalem? Well, God had promised the Israelites that they would conquer the land, and that included all these little pockets, including the little Jebusite town here. And so the Israelites really needed to take courage that God would fulfill his promise that they would conquer and take over Jerusalem because it belonged to them. It didn't belong to the Jebusites anymore. God had given it to them. And so as they see David appear with this kind of gruesome head, they would be encouraged. God is true. God can be trusted in. So I want to ask you, have you seen God do something amazing? Have you seen God in your own life be faithful to you? If you have, share it. Hold it up. Let us know. It's encouraging. We want to hear. You know, maybe yours is just where you were rebellious and you have wounds and scars to prove it, but today your life is transformed and you follow hard after God because of what Jesus has done for you. Hold that story up. Lift it up. Let everyone know. Because it helps us as we're facing our own battles, as we're facing our own giants. Maybe this morning, if you can't think of anything to hold up, you can't think of a time in which you've seen God deliver you, maybe you need to step out on the field. Instead of sitting back and letting others do the heavy lifting, don't just sit on that throne like King Saul and miss out being used by God. Start preparing, start training. You see, I want to be clear. It's not that we all like grab our bicycles and we go after all the tanks of our enemies. That's not what I think is the point here. The point is, when we see these taunting and boasting heads before us, we go up to them and say, I believe in God. He is my deliverer. He is true. Jesus is the Lord of all. And it's not that we do that in this arrogant way. We do it in love. We do it through self-sacrifice. But we step out onto the field and we trust our God to fight that battle for us. As we pray this morning, if there's someone who knows of a giant that they need to face, please text me. That's why we have that number, so you can communicate with us. It's on the back of your bulletin. I think it's 233-6611. Let me know. I promise to get in touch with you, to talk to you about that if you'd like, or just pray with you and pray as that is happening that God would show himself faithful and deliver you in an amazing way so that you can hold up that story and proclaim God's goodness. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much that you are faithful to your people, that you are faithful to a confident boy who trusted in you and knew that your honor and your glory and your fame needed to be upheld. Lord, I pray as we think and consider the things that need to be confronted, Lord, that we would not be afraid, that we would not shrink back, that we would know that we serve a God who acts. We serve a God who is concerned about his name. We serve a God who wants to distinguish himself as the God and the authority of our world. Lord, help us to be faithful. Help us not to be afraid. Help us not to cower. Help us to trust in you. And Lord, help us to train well. Help us to be prepared. Lord, help us to have that vertical vision that we need, to know that you can do far more than we ask or imagine. Lord, I pray that you would go with us this week, that you would be with us, that we would honor you in all that we do. In Jesus' name I pray, amen.